Possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, celebrating the 75th anniversary of the College of Fine and Applied Arts on Saturday, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Graham Jennings and Masumi Rostad will join the symphony as they perform works by Schumann, Mozart, Machen, and more. More information is available at 333-6280.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on WILL AM 580. Also online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Are you looking for the guys? Well, you might try the garage, the basement, the backyard grill, or the pool hall, maybe the bar. On the program today, we're going to take a look inside male spaces. Thanks in part to a dog-eared copy of an Esquire magazine in the hair salon where writer James Twitchell gets his hair cut, we are going to get a glimpse inside male spaces. That magazine featured some photographs taken by Ken Ross. The photographs included a midget race car in a garage, an empty boxing ring, and a model train set. Twitchell was intrigued, and it wasn't long before Twitchell was on the phone with Ross, and they decided to team up to explore the places men go to find comfort and camaraderie and hide out. The result is the new book, Where Men Hide. Twitchell provides the copy and Ross the photographs for the book. James Twitchell is professor of English and advertising at the University of Florida and the author of many books, including Ad Cult USA and Lead Us Into Temptation. Ken Ross has been a photographer and educator for more than 30 years. His work has been displayed in numerous exhibits and featured in the New York Times and Esquire. Their book, Where Men Hide, is published by Columbia University Press. James Twitchell, Ken Ross, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
I've got the first question I would like both of you to answer, one at a time, of course. And let's start with James, or may I call you Jim?
Jim is fine.
Okay. Jim, where do you hide?
In my office.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I really don't need my office. I could work at home, but I like to go there. It has a door. I can keep it closed. So for me, it's my office.
And Ken?
I think I hide behind my camera, actually. I've sort of dispensed with my dark room in recent months due to sort of phasing my work into a digital output. But for the 30 years or so that I've been a photographer, I think I hide behind the viewfinder of my camera, actually.
Yeah. Do women hide?
They don't hide the way men do.
Yeah.
I mean, women enjoy going off to the spa together or shopping together. I don't think they're as discombobulated by having a male along as men are if they were to, say, go to deer camp with a woman.
Right. I have to agree with Jim. I think of my wife in terms of the social relationships that she has, and it's sort of important for me to go off on my own, and I think it's very important for her to go off with other women. So,
There is a chapter in this book that looks at the bachelor pad, so to speak, a room of one's own. A Room of His Own is what you've titled the chapter. Of course, it is a draw from A Room of One's Own. What do we see in the photos in this chapter, Ken?
Are you referring to the one of, I believe it's my my uncle. I had a bachelor uncle who, for virtually his entire adult life, lived with my parents. And the room that Jim spends most of the time talking about in the chapter, that was his bedroom in my parents' home. And the clothes are folded on the bed, and he has family mementos and war medals on the wall, and a television right next to the bed. And we call them Unky, and essentially that was the place where he hid from the rest of the family. Actually,
yeah, there's also a picture, a photograph of a bachelor's bed in Maine.
Absolutely,
and there is another one of. Let me see what it is called here. Matt, Eric, Joe, and Bo's Girl Wall, Rhode Island.
Right. That's from my son's college room, and those were his four male roommates. And throughout the year, they found pictures of young ladies, basically, and they sort of peppered their wall with pictures of lovely women, along with, again, another television and numerous beer bottles and the paraphernalia that goes with being a young male.
Yeah. The television is in each
photograph. Mm-hmm. It was really, as I found private spaces for men, the TV became sort of a large part of their experience. Yeah. And the way I photographed them, the technique, it's nothing special. It's just that they were long exposures, and I didn't use any extra light. So when the TV was on, it comes out as sort of a glowing orb, in the middle of the frame.
Yeah, and Jim, as you suggest, television, one of men's best friends.
Well, and is the place where, along with the Internet, men go to hide.
Mm-hmm. How has television and other screens that we surround ourselves with, perhaps we arm ourselves with them, how have they changed our spaces, both for men and for women?
Well, Ken has a great photograph of his father's lazy boy. Mm. There's no lazy girl, even though they tried to market it. Women didn't really need that little cocoon to crawl into, the way men seem to. And of course, if you look at what the lazy boy is used for, it's used to quietly sort of decompress your consciousness as you're watching television, very often aided by cold brew, and you sort of slide across into this other world, whether you're watching sports or some show. I think it's more a man's sort of path into privacy than it is a woman's.
Yeah.
I think Jim phrased it. He phrased it really well when he dealt with that chapter. And he said that some men hide in full sight. And my father's chair was right in the corner of the living room. But we all knew that. He had the remote control sort of lined up on the table, and we knew not to go near his chair, basically. But it was in plain sight. Actually, it was like an invisible wall was up that we couldn't go through.
Right, right. I really love that photograph. And if we're listeners, think in your pull up from your memory the living room in the sitcom Frasier.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got Dad's recliner. And there's a dog in the story, too. And there's a television in front of the recliner. It's all there in Frasier in that living room. I don't know, Jim, if you want to pick up on that.
Well, the dog, I suppose, sort of invokes a man's best friend.
Yeah.
It's kind of a man's best friend, wink, wink. Clearly, I don't think dogs would be man's best friends, but it certainly is one of the few animals that a man feels comfortable in the company of. And I did a little riff on Lassie,
mm-hmm.
Who, oddly enough, is a female. But the whole history of men and their animals, men and dogs, and men being alone with dogs. In fact, one of my favorite TV shows was a show called Hunting with Hank on the Outdoor Network. And all it is just two cameramen who are following this guy as he's hunting upland game with his dog, and that's the hunting with Hank. The Hank is the dog.
And what kinds of things did they do? Did you just see them walk around?
Because the show, we have the guy who's doing the hunting. He's talking. He's got a sort of a lavalier mic, and he's talking about what he's what he sees and his dog, and he calls and talks to his dog, and we're sort of like on the fourth wall. We're just sort of looking over his shoulder as he's hunting. Every once in a while, he kills a bird, and we have to pick the bird up, talk about the bird. But there's no one else. Usually, there's no one else there. And I was amazed when I started to watch this show how addictive it was. And then I realized, wait a minute, this show is on the air on the Outdoor Network, because clearly other guys are sitting there quietly pretending that they're... And the whole thing is filmed from the point of view of you're the other person there in the field. It gets kind of a strange and a truly bizarre sensation. But, I mean, I think that when you observe these places and men in these places, very often they do seem kind of bizarre.
Yeah. What do you think of the show where the men, a father and his sons, build choppers?
Well, yeah. Have you seen that, Ken?
Oh, absolutely.
Here it is.
I'm a disciple.
Yeah, this is the Discovery Network's, number one rated show for men. And there are very few women, a couple women, but not many. And it's these guys who are putting together these works of art. Mm-hmm. And, they're it's like Michelangelo and Leonardo. They're really powerful craftsmen. But if you listen to what they're saying to each other, I mean, they're saying the most vulgar, vapid, stupid things like, I'm going to hit you up the head with this 2x4.
Right.
And once again, it's something that men enjoy watching. It's this male space.
It sounds like when you're playing basketball with a group of other men.
Yeah. I've seen the show a couple of times because my husband enjoys watching it from time to time. And once he was not feeling well, and thank God they were running it back-to-back-to-back overnight. It kept his mind off his troubles, I think.
Oh, and of course, it's the same show, every week. It's
yeah.
The same show. They're building just another bike, but it's all this interaction between these guys.
Yeah. And I look at it, and it's fascinating for a little while, but then it's like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Women look at it, and they say, change the channel. I think men say, well, give me some more. I'll watch some more.
There seems to be numerous variants of it, too, now. They're, cropping up on the Discovery station and, lots of other stations, actually. So it's, I think success is actually there. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can't imagine myself. I don't know. I think it's interesting that there are these programs then, I guess, like American Chopper, where men, are they making things together like that? Because I can't imagine, as a woman, wanting to sit down and watch women make things together.
Well, wait a minute, because there are plenty of cooking shows or, arts and crafts shows.
Right.
Where, women are watching women and men. I think what made the chopper show so intriguing is we couldn't do that. He's not teaching. That family is not teaching me how to make that object the way a cooking show teaches me how to make a souffle. What they're doing is they're showing me people who are doing things I couldn't conceivably do and what it is that they talk about while they're doing it, which they're wonderfully vulgar. They've got nothing to do with, great art or aspiration or, religiosity. It's...
vulgarity.
It's vulgarity.
So it's a little bit like seeing maybe what the conversation would be like at a deer camp.
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much.
What is a deer camp?
Well, Ken knows. Ken, why don't you do this?
Deer camp is, that's the first chapter that we dealt with. And deer camps are similar to... other places, there's a duck blind that's in there, and these are places that are set aside for ostensibly for hunting. The deer camps that were photographed in the book, they were friends of Jim's up in Vermont, and way back into the woods, and at hunting season, a group of men would get together, and they'd go up to the camp for a weekend or extended period of time, and they would, you know, not only socialize. I think probably just the socializing was, you know, it was an excuse to go, and they'd go off into the woods to, you know, to hunt. And you know, the pictures sort of tell the story. And Jim's chapter, you know, details the, you know, the other, you know, the other activities that can take place there. You know, cards and drinking and telling stories and the things that go with men being together.
Yeah.
The key, I think, is that the men who go to this deer camp, they don't go to the camp to hunt the deer because they're going to bring the deer home to eat. These guys could easily drive into the woods, park, and go hunting for the day. They go to deer camp to be with the other guys, and incidental to that, they hunt the deer. Very often they don't actually go out and hunt, or if they go out and hunt, in fact, my friend who goes there very often goes out with an empty gun. They just enjoy the rough camaraderie of being out in the woods together.
To hang out.
Yeah, and I mean, perish the thought that they actually shoot a deer and have to, you know, field dress it. That's what I loved about Ken's got some great photographs of what happens to the deer when they're brought back.
Right.
There are two wonderful shots of a gutted deer hanging in a beer cooler. You know, this is not to eat. This is, well, it's part of this male initiation.
Yeah. And also another thing, one of the things that you write about in that chapter, Jim, is the ramshackle nature of the deer camp. And I think that also helps explain the draw.
Yeah, it's not just to go there during deer season. These guys go during the summertime together to fix and get the deer camp ready. And you'd think to yourself, well, they do it every year. Why don't they just, you know, make it so it doesn't need fixing? And clearly they don't, because they enjoy that process as well.
Yeah. It strikes me that it's a little bit like a treehouse for adult men.
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
Very much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Many of the places were like that I, you know, I finally, you know, that wound up in the book, in the photographs, actually.
Maybe you'd describe one of the photographs of the deer camp. There are two. They're very early in the chapter, a west view and an east view.
There, it's the same, you know, it's the same room, and you know, there's sort of handmade bunks and an old kitchen table that was probably employed into service with a plastic cover. There was no electricity. There was a generator that we fired up to put a little bit of the light in there, and you know, it's just covered with memorabilia of you know, that these men have brought up there, you know, over the course of the years of having it been used. And I think they felt very comfortable when they, you know, went in there. Very primitive sort of kitchen area, and I you know, it was great when we went up there. It wasn't during deer season, and you know, we opened the door and we sort of felt right at home, actually.
Yeah. There's a candle and a
An old Chianti bottle with a candle stuck in it. And everything is there. You know, the pictures are all. You know, they're found locales, actually. So, you know, Jim sort of pointed us in that direction, but there's very little that I rearranged. I just, you know, a couple of things were clarified and an object moved here or there just to make the picture more clear, actually. But all of the photographs in the book were sort of found, they're found essentially the way they were.
Yeah. So in the west view, we get the bunks, the old ice box, beer signs.
Yeah, and you can actually see the plumbing sort of hanging, the water going into the shower is coming through the polyurethane pipes that are literally hanging down from the ceiling.
Yeah, it's very, you know, but, you know, how many of us make this kind of thing anymore? I mean, you know, run our own plumbing, for example, you know? There's something that is appealing there, I think, you know?
I think that's...
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
part of the simplicity of it, you know?
Yeah. We can do this. Yeah, sure. Let's run a couple of tubes.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the fact that what you see there would have been there for their fathers and their grandfathers.
Right.
It's a kind of fraternal nostalgia. And very often inside these deer camps, they'll keep little, you know, journals, diaries, and they're quite touching when you read them because they're not at all... braggadocio. They're very tender. You know, they're saying, I'm up here with my uncle, and my grandfather used to be here, and I'm here. It's sort of, you know, male historic space.
Hmm. And when they get home, when the men get home, though, I don't know if that kind of detail would come out in the conversation with women. Would it?
I doubt it.
Mm. Yeah.
In fact, you know, most of the stuff that goes on in deer camp goes on, at least the intriguing stuff, I think, once the men start to sort of rebarbarize, they start to lose all the things that they've been, all their good manners, quote-unquote, and, you know, using language they couldn't use at home, eating food that they couldn't eat at home, and, you know, urination is, you know, celebrated all through the night, the very thing that...
Out the door.
The very thing the middle-aged man feels sort of in the confines of his own bed with his wife as a kind of mild embarrassment, namely he's getting up to go to the bathroom to take a pee at night. At deer camp, this goes on all night long, and there's a great deal of guffawing about it, and it's sort of the shared experience of what it is to be man.
Yeah. Garrison Keillor, I heard, actually he was on the radio several weeks ago, and you know, after the book had been published, and he did a piece on a friend of his, well, ostensibly it was a friend of his, who decided that he wanted to go to deer camp on his own, and he wanted to bring Italian sheets and a bottle of wine and take a bath when he got there. It was this long story, but he wanted to bring out his gentler side, and actually he was... You know, he was finally discovered by his other friends that were there, and it was really hysterical about how he had to hide this hide this part of himself when he he went up to deer camp. So it was really kind of interesting.
Yeah, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, photographer Ken Ross, and James Twitchell, writer James Twitchell. They have worked together on the book Where Men Hide. James. Jim Twitchell provided the copy, the essays, and the photographs provided by photographer Ken Ross. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question or a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for doing the show. I'm really interested in your take on maleness that you present in this inquiry through this book. And despite the asociality that you bring up that men like in hiding from the lazy boy chair, that seems to be something that's pretty common. And you say that females have more of a sense of sociality. In the deer camp, it seems like sociology is pretty important and it's just hanging out. Also, in cooking shows, it's mostly men who watch those now, so I'm wondering if men hide in the kitchen also. And I'm wondering if there's a non-white element to this, if this is mostly white men you're talking about. And the last question that I had in all this is just that so much of what you're talking about in maleness seems to boil down to what I'm hearing, and I haven't read your book, so I'm just getting a small snippet, but it seems to boil down to non-femaleness. So I'm wondering if non-female spaces is really important to how you see maleness, how you see men getting a being in hiding. I'm wondering if you could talk on any of these, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, a number of things there.
Well, Ken, do you want to do that? I mean, I
was going to pass.
Jim's
okay,
off.
You go first.
Jim's off to
and
deer
I'll,
camp.
I'll start, then you can
okay.
Correct me.
No.
let me see. The first and obvious thing about the images that Ken delivered to me, the thing that I couldn't get beyond, was how dark and drab and dingy they look. A male space is not a happy meal. It's not exultant or particularly colorful. That's what I really loved about the black and whiteness of Ken's images. I think that men, I think they have to sort of struggle with the fact that getting together with other men is an effort. It's not something, it seems to me, the way women experience getting
right.
together with other women. Women, I mean, if I can just observe my wife, she's in book clubs. She goes out for lunch with no trouble. I mean, when I want to have someone go to the movies with me, I've got to do something elaborate. Or if I want to be with guys, I've got to go get four for golf or four for tennis. It's not it's not as simple for men, and that's one reason why I thought the most intriguing of the things to think about was the fact that 50 years ago, the average American middle-class male spent 4 hours a week at his lodge, if it was the Masonic Lodge or the Elks or the Moose or whatnot, and that he had to go through this elaborate process of getting funny clothes put on and special initiation ceremonies. I mean, when these guys got together, what they did 99% of the time is initiate each other. You know, why can't guys just get together the way women do? And clearly, it's much more, it's much deeper and complicated and is tied into all kinds of, I think, tensions between, you know, male hunting, male tribalizing, and male civilized and socialized.
Yeah.
Yours, Ken.
Yeah, and I think as I was ironically, I was just having a conversation about this yesterday. Traveling into New York with another couple, and my wife and this gentleman's wife, you know, sort of walked away, and we were talking about going exercising and working out, and the conversation ultimately came down to my wife would love me to go to the gym with her and other folks and talk while we exercise, and frankly that's like the last thing that I ever want to do if I ever get myself to exercise. What I'd rather do is put on an iPod, get in there, do it by myself, and get it over with. And I think that that's a direct reflection of what Jim's talking about. And it's I think it is more difficult for men to have the kind of relationship that women have with other women. I don't think that they necessarily want it. And I think it's, as he talked about, it's this hunting thing that we go back to, and it's a provider kind of a thing, and it's you know, a display of individual strength. And I think that's sort of what it comes down to. And men tend to be often combative and you know, competitive when they get together in groups. I'm sure women are, but I think perhaps it's maybe on a different level.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me men don't pick up the phone just to chat with their buddies.
No.
You need an activity. You need to suggest something or say, hey, you know.
Yeah. Jim, how many times did we call each other when we did this book?
Very few.
Really? I mean, he was doing his job, and I did my job.
Yeah, and I'm thinking it's kind of intriguing because, you know, men do get together, not on the phone, but the huge internet gambling phenomenon of, you know, guys who are playing poker online.
Right.
Where they never have to deal with the other guy as a thinking, breathing character, but he's just someone you can compete with and keep score with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, something else that the caller mentioned was, you know, the issue of class and race.
Well, here, yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah. I did a chapter with Ken's images on the barbershop. And, of course, the barbershop, which has now become unisexed for a great deal of culture, is still in the African-American world primarily male only. In fact, the movie Barbershop and then the sequel Barbershop have this site of Chicago downtown barbershop as a place where men go. I don't think it's unique to race, and I don't think it's unique to class. I mean, the people who were members of the English male upper class Victorian clubs, or the people who are members of the 1940s Order of the Elk, I mean, those were wildly different classes. One was English upper class, and the other one was American lower middle class. Seems to me that men, irrespective of race or class, yearn for and are confused by, have troubles with, and feel relaxation in the company of other men.
Hmm. You know, the barbershop for most people has become, or for many people, has become the hair salon. And I think also, though, at the hair salon, other forms of segregation are on the wane as well. Anyway, what I wanted Jim to talk about is how did this transformation of where we get our hair cut or styled happen?
Well, it happens, oddly enough, in the 1960s with the Beatles and with men growing hair that had to be styled. It was now shoulder-length long hair. And it's then that the unisex hair salon comes into being. Strangely enough, I just got an email from a guy who is an entrepreneur bringing back the male-only barbershop. He has a company called Roosters, and it's going to be just men, and drink beer, have your hair cut, and have the same experience that I had. Maybe you too, Ken, when you were young.
Absolutely.
That you know, you went, you got dropped off.
Right.
Before you knew how to get on your bicycle, you got dropped off. You went in there, you saw all these great magazines like Argosy and Police Gazette.
Field and Stream.
Field and Stream. You sat up in the chair. The guy cuts your hair. There's a lot of banter going on. You never complain. You never whine. You never come home in tears saying, my hair doesn't look right. I have two daughters. They would very often come home saying, oh, this is terrible. And I was thinking to myself, well, that was just your hair. It'll grow back. but that was part of the initiation of getting your hair cut. Now, when I get my hair cut, I go to one of these places where no one says a word. It might very well be a woman cutting my hair or a woman next to me. It's just, you can hear a pin drop.
Ken, what's your experience?
Well, the barbershop that leads you off the chapter, it's a Rich's Cuts USA. He was a former, he used to cut men and women's hair, and he decided to just try to exclusively do men. And it's he's the fastest barber in the world. You go in there, and it's and within 3 minutes, you know, I mean, I don't have that much hair left anyway, but within 3 minutes, you have your hair cut. And I've occasionally seen a woman come through the door, but it's really kind of strange when she comes in. And everything that Jim says, I walked into the shop where the single chair is in the photograph that's in that chapter, and it's an old barber shop in South Jersey, and it's filled with football helmets and you know, war medals and all kinds of paraphernalia that's all around the war, and you know, generally that's men in that one as well.
Yeah,
and you know, men used to go into the barber shop not just for the haircut but also to get shaved, and also during Prohibition to buy alcohol. Mm-hmm. You could spit. There were spittoons. You know, very often where men spit is where they feel women are no longer going to be around. And it's kind of intriguing, the dugout. Ken has a photograph of that. The barbershop were places where men would spit.
Yeah. I remember as a kid walking my brothers to the barbershop, and then I would, you know, stay for a minute or two. But then I'd leave. I love the way it smelled, but it wasn't my place, you know?
Yeah.
And the place for the women was upstairs, and it didn't smell good at all up there.
Well, the same way you felt in the male barbershop is how Ken and I feel
right.
In the beauty salon, which is we're bowls in a china shop.
Yeah.
Although where I go these days, it's the stylists are men and women, and the clientele, men and women. Although I think that... this is my observation, that when all the clients in the salon are women, there's a different vibe.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Than when men come in.
And I think the age of the men that we're talking about has something to do with this as well. My son is 25, and I often think of him in regards to this book. And at 25, I think he's still hiding from mom and dad. I'm certain that he's not necessarily hiding from women, you know. So I think you have to have a certain place in terms of your own maturity, or you know, your relationships with the other sex, that's going to, you know, lead you into some of the places that we represent in the book.
Yeah. So are some of the places, disappearing,
mm-hmm.
where men hide, where ladies lunch, they're disappearing. Do you think that's where we're headed long term? Is it, you know, by and large, except maybe for the deer camp and a couple of other spaces?
Well, I don't think they're going to go away completely. I think Jim makes a great point about perhaps community communities of men are waning. But I think on an individual basis, almost, you know, many of the married men that I talk to tend to have a place of their own. I think what's rapidly disappearing is that sense of male community that you know, Jim touches on really well, and you know, the chapter on the you know, the Masonic Lodge.
Yeah, that space, as Jim mentioned a while ago, though, maybe is the space is virtual now rather
mm-hmm.
than a physical place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But everyone I talk to that sees the book in terms of the pictures, they know somebody that I should go and photograph, or they, you know, their husbands, or and it, you know, I think that'll keep going on an individual basis.
Yeah. In your conclusion, Jim, you write about objects following a logic of gender. And you quote a guy by the name of Ernest Dichter, "A sedan is a wife, but a convertible is a mistress." Mm-hmm. And you think spaces can work the same way. They're often gendered. Maybe you would expand on that, talk about that a little bit.
Well, in advertising, one of the sort of bromides of advertising is before you think about how to sell a product, you have to think about what is its sex. In romance languages, of course, objects do have sex. They have gender. And, you know if a chair is a female or male, whereas in English we don't. And my suspicions are that the more we observe space, the more aware we'll be that there really is gendered space and that there's nothing right or wrong, you know, nothing necessarily exclusionary about one as opposed to the other. It's that certain levels of comfort and quietude. And, you know, I look at these pictures of Ken's, and I just feel at ease. Very often I think women would look at the same image and say, ooh, I want to fix that. I want to tighten that. I want to clean that up. And, you know, the great transformation that's been our lifetime is we've lost or exchanged many of these single-sex spaces, mm-hmm. I think especially men, for sort of tipping the hat to let's play fair. And it's a powerful argument that feminists made and still make, that if this space is here to exclude us, no fair. But the argument that I think both Ken and I make is very often this is just space because it's comfortable. It's not to keep women out. It's sort of to make men feel at ease.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the biographical sketch of the two of you that came with the book, Ken, you say you used to hide in forts that you and your friends made in trees, mm-hmm. underground, and in the snow.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that there's something universal about this. There's something in us from the time we're children that draws us to make these places.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that really set me off was when Saddam Hussein was captured, for about a week, nobody had any video of what the place looked like. So newspapers all over the world had to generate sort of pictographs in newspapers, you know, cutaways, 3D images. None of them got it right, but what I thought was so intriguing is that every culture that had a newspaper had an image of what they took, Saddam's spider hole, hidey hole, rat's nest, whatever it was, that they imaged it. Because clearly men wanted to see what that's like. You know, where do men go when they're literally, I mean, this time it's not hiding at all from women, and it's really not to be with other men. It's just hiding from being hit with a bomb on top of your head. Mm. But still, you know, the men go down under the ground. You know, they burrow. They have these little messes they like to make. And I think it really is trans-cultural.
Yeah, I think there. I can add. I think I found that the many of the men that whose places I photographed, you know, they're other than when they were at work, most of their social life was completely controlled by their wives, and most of the men in there, you know, aside from the ones that are labeled clearly as a bachelor's kind of a place, they're much of the whole home thing, the whole family scene, basically, what was orchestrated by their wives, and I think getting sort of away from that and hiding in their own space, in their own hidey hole, as it were, I think they found a little control, you know, really. I really do. And that would be the place often that they could go and, you know, satisfy, you know, their interests. One woman, I was photographing, it was a train set that's up in the top of a barn. And when I was photographing that, the wife of the man whose place it was came out, and I started to talk to her about the project, and I explained it to her. And she said, it's literally everything that was banished from my home. And that was, that's what was put up in the attic of the barn.
Mm. And I think that guy should definitely have that space, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So did she. She was very glad he did.
I don't know if the two of you listen to Car Talk.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But often they get men and women calling in and saying, you make the call. And it's interesting because when it's a woman calling in and she wants her husband to clean out the garage, they say, leave him alone. But then when it's a guy calling in and he wants to hang on to this unsafe at any speed clunker, and they're about to have a baby, the guys say, get rid of it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you're in the market for a Volvo now, or, you know.
Well, cars are intriguing because you look at the advertisements for the SUVs when they first came out 10 years ago, and it's all men who are using this car to go out into the outback. When you actually looked at how the car got used, that's how the car got sold, how the car got used. It was used by the wife to go down to Kmart.
Absolutely.
It never left the macadam. It never used the four-wheel drive. I mean, it was sold as a basis of escape. It was used as a basis of domestic life.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. What do you make of the Hummer?
Oh, what a jerkmobile! I mean, really, really. I mean, what an incredible jerkmobile! It's a tribute to kind of the wild
how to be manipulated
of men. I mean, this thing is, I'm driving a tank, and I'm going to drive it over you. It's not very.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of sympathy for it.
It's not very sophisticated, no. But we can certainly understand why it's alluring.
Yes.
Yeah. Thoughts about the Miata?
That's more interesting.
Well, Ken had a great. This is one of the first images that I saw of Ken's of a little midget race car in a garage,
mm-hmm.
And I was intrigued by the image because it was just every adolescent boy's idea of where he wanted to spend time. It's this kind of a garage with all sorts of automotive stuff on the walls and this beautiful little midget. And I was aware when I looked at this image that Ken shot how close it was to the first ads for the Mazda Miata, where this car that really was an incredibly powerful in the car market. Now there are 8 or 9 of the sort of knockoffs of this car. When it was first advertised, it was advertised looking almost exactly like Ken's shot of the midget racer. It's in a garage, you know, it's sort of heroically lit, and it's all set to take you, well, not even out with your best girl, it's just set to take you away. And I was just amazed at how powerful this image was when I saw it of Ken's, and then realizing, oh, that was the image that was used to sell the Miata.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of which, in retrospect, I'm sort of embarrassed to admit I bought. I mean, embarrassed because it's clearly, you know,
a
at the time, a 55-year-old pretending he's 18.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, I can see men and women driving the Miata, but I really can't see women driving a Hummer too much.
No, I can't either.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. We're out of time. I wanted to ask you about church, but we'll just have to tell folks to go look for where men hide. That was very interesting, the mega church. but we don't have enough time to talk about it now. We're out of time. Just been a pleasure talking with the two of you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks so much for joining us this afternoon, and you're about to embark on a road trip, I guess.
Well, a little bit. We were going to do it together, but now it looks as if we're going to go apart. Well, maybe we'll do a little bit together.
Mm. Well, the best to the two of you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Ken Ross and Jim Twitchell have been our guests this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. James Twitchell is the author of Where Men Ride and the photographs in the book by Ken Ross. The publisher is Columbia. And that interview conducted on May 8th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, 67 degrees in Urbana. Now let's hand things off to Todd Gleason. Todd, what happened today with commodity prices?
Over at the Chicago Board of Trade today, futures were lower, Celeste, and we'll start in the wheat pit where we always do, the nearby September contract leading things down. It was 2 cents lower today. 399.5, the high, the low at 394. Settlement price for the soft red winter wheat down 2 cents. December futures were off 2.5 at 413. They had a high of 414.5 and a low at 407.75, and the March wheat a 432.5 high low, low at 426, and a settlement price at 430.5. Once again, they were down 3.5 cents for the day. May contract in the wheat pit a 440 high, low at 435.5. Settlement price there at $4.40, down a penny. And the July off a penny and 3/4, 446, the high, the low at 439.5. Settlement at 445.5. September corn futures down 3 cents. 229.5 the high, the low at 225. Settled at $2.28.75. They were off 3. December futures, your lead option, or rather your harvest month option, down 2.5 cents today. 243.5 the settlement price for the Dease corn. Settlement and the high and the low range at 244.5 and the low at 239.75. March contract 258.5 the high, the low at 54. Settled at 257.25. They were down 2.75 today. And the May corn down 3 cents. 266 the high, the low at 62.25. Settlement price is 265.25. They were off 3. July futures 274.25 the high, the low at 70.25. Settlement price is $2.73.5 a bushel, down 3 cents. December next year 290.5 the high, the low at 84.5. Settlement price at $2.88 even. They were down 3.25. SEP oats were unchanged. Actually, didn't trade today. 188 was settlement price there. December futures 193.75 the high, the low at 191. December oats are 193.75 settlement price. They finished unchanged. September soybean futures 535.5 the high, the low at 30.5. Settlement price at 532 off a nickel. November's at 547 on the high, the low at 42.25. Settlement price there at 544.5. And they finished 3.5 cents lower. January futures 560.25 the high, the low at 55.5. Settlement price at 537.75, down 4. And the March contract 572 the high, the low price at 567.5. Settled at 569.75. They were off 3.5 for the day. May futures 581 the high, the low at 78. Settlement price at $5.79, down 3/4, at 79.75, down 4.25 for the day. And the July contract finished 3.25 lower at 5.